Side 8, The Sapphire Rose, by David Eddings. Continuing on page 258. Age has dimmed my eyes, it seems, Zalasta noted. Now that I look more closely at his face, I can indeed see that this is Sir Sparhawk. The light of his purpose shines all around him.
Zalasta has offered us his aid, Sparhawk, Sophronia said then. He is very wise and deeply schooled in the secrets.
We would be honored, learned one, Sparhawk said. Zalasta smiled. I would be of small use on your quest, Sir Sparhawk, he said in a slightly self-deprecating way. Were you to encase me in steel, I'm sure I would wither like a flower. Sparhawk tapped his breastplate. It's an Aline affectation, learned one, he said, like pointed hats or brocade doublets. We can only hope that someday steel wardrobes will go out of fashion. I had always thought Alines to be a humorless race, the Styrek noted. But you are droll, Sir Sparhawk. I would be of little use to you on your trek, but at some future time I may be able to assist you in some other matter of a certain importance.
Trek? Sparhawk asked.
I know not where you and my sister will go, Sir Knight, but I perceive many leagues hovering about you both. I have come to advise you both to steel your hearts and to be ever watchful. A danger avoided is sometimes preferable to a danger overcome. Zalasta looked around. And my presence here is one of those avoidable dangers, I think. You are cosmopolitan, Sir Sparhawk, but I think that perhaps some of your comrades may be less sophisticated. He bowed to Sparhawk, kissed Sophronia's palms, and then glided silently back up the shadowy side passage.
I haven't seen him in more than a century, Sophronia said. He's changed, just a little.
Most of us would change in that long a period, little mother. Sparhawk smiled. Except you, of course.
You're such a nice boy, Sparhawk. She sighed. It all seems so long ago. Zalasta was always so serious when he was a child. Even then he was wise beyond belief. His grasp of the secrets is profound.
What's this trek he was talking about?
Do you mean to say you can't feel it? You can't feel the distance stretching in front of you?
Not noticeably, no.
Alines, she sighed, sometimes I'm surprised that you can even feel the seasons turn.
He ignored that.
Where are we going?
I don't know. Not even Zalasta can perceive that. The future lying before us is dark, Sparhawk. I should have known that it would be. But I didn't think my way completely through it, I guess. We are going someplace, though. Why aren't you with Alana?
The kings are all being solicitous. I can't get near her.
He paused.
Sophronia. She can see it, too. The shadow, I mean. I think it's probably because she's wearing one of the rings.
That would stand to reason. Belion's useless without the rings.
Does it put her in any kind of danger?
Of course it does, Sparhawk. But Alana's been in danger since the day she was born.
Isn't that just a little fatalistic?
Perhaps. I just wish I could see this shadow of yours. I might be able to identify it a little more precisely.
I can borrow Alana's ring and give them both to you, he offered. Then you can take Belion out of the pouch. I can almost guarantee that you'll see the shadow at that point.
Don't even suggest that, Sparhawk, she shuddered. I wouldn't be much good to you if I were suddenly to vanish, permanently.
Sophronia, he said a bit critically, was I some sort of an experiment? You keep warning everybody not to touch Belion, but you didn't even turn a hair when you were telling me to chase it down and take it away from Gwerig. Wasn't I in a certain amount of danger, too? Did you just wait to see if I'd explode when I put my hands on it?
Don't be silly, Sparhawk. Everyone knows that you were destined to wield Belion.
I didn't.
Let's not pursue this, dear one. We have enough problems already. Just accept the fact that you and Belion are linked. I think that shadow should be our concern right now. What is it, and what is it doing?
It seems to be following Belion and the rings. Can we discount the things Perrine was trying to do? Wasn't that Martell's idea, one that he came up with on his own?
I don't know that we'd be safe to assume that. Martell was controlling Perrine, but something else may have been controlling Martell, without his even knowing it.
I see that this is going to be another of the kind of discussions that gives me headaches.
Just take precautions, dear one, she told him. Don't relax your guard. Let's see if we can catch up with Alama. She'll be upset if you're not attentive.
They were all somewhat subdued when they gathered together that evening. This time, however, they did not gather in the Pandion chapter house, but rather in a large, over-decorated chamber attached to the archprelate's personal apartments. The room was normally the site of the meetings of the highest councils of the church, and they had assembled there at Sarathi's personal request. Tinian, Sparhawk noticed, was conspicuously absent. The walls of the room were paneled, and it was adorned with blue drapes and carpeting. A very large religious fresco decorated the ceiling. Talon looked up and sniffed disdainfully.
I could do a better job than that with my left hand, he declared.
There's a thought, Curic said. I think I'll ask Dolmand if he'd like to have the ceiling of the nave here in the basilica decorated.
Curic, Talon said with some shock, that ceiling's bigger than a cow pasture. It'd take 40 years to paint enough pictures to cover it.
You're young, Curic shrugged. Steady work might keep you out of trouble. The door opened and Dolmand entered. They all rose from their seats and genuflected.
Please, Dolmand said wearily, spare me. People have been doing that ever since the overly clever Queen of Elenia jammed me into a seat I didn't really want.
Why, Sarathi, she protested, what a thing to say. We have things to discuss, my friends, Dolmand said, and decisions to make. He took his seat at the head of the large conference table in the center of the room. Please, sit down and let's get to work. When would you like to have us schedule your coronation, Sarathi? Patriarch Emban asked. That can wait. Let's push Otha off our doorstep first. I don't think I'd care to have him attend. How do we proceed? King Worgen looked around. I'll throw out some ideas and see how the rest respond, he said. The way I see it, we've got two options. We can march east until we run into the Zamoks and then fight them in open fields, or we can move out until we find suitable terrain and stop and wait for them. The first option would keep Otha farther away from Kyrelos, and the second would give us time to erect field fortifications. Both approaches have their advantages, and they both have their drawbacks as well. He looked around again. What do you think? He asked.
I think we need to know what kind of a force we're facing, King Dragoth said.
There are a lot of people in Zamok, old King Obler said.
That's God's own truth, Worgen scowled. They breed like rabbits.
We can expect to be outnumbered, then, Obler continued. If I remember my military strategy correctly, that would almost compel us to take up defensive positions. We'll have to erode Otha's forces before we can go on the offensive.
Another siege, Comyr groaned. I hate sieges.
We don't always get what we want, Comyr, Avriel told him. There's a third option, however, King Worgen. There are many fortified keeps and castles in Lamorkand. We can move out, occupy those strongholds in force, and hold them. Otha won't be able to bypass them, because if he does, the troops inside will be able to come out and decimate his reserves and destroy his supply trains.
Lord Avriel, Worgen said, that strategy will spread us out all over central Lamorkand.
I'll admit that it has drawbacks, Avriel conceded. But the last time Otha invaded, we met him head-on at Lake Rundera. We virtually depopulated the continent in the process, and it took centuries for Eosia to recover. I'm not sure we want to repeat that.
We won, didn't we? Worgen said bluntly. Do we really want to win that way again?
There may be another alternative, Sparhawk said quietly.
I'd certainly be glad to hear it. Preceptor Darylon said. I'm not too happy with any of the options I've heard so far.
Sephrania, Sparhawk said. Just how powerful is the Belium, really?
I've told you that it's the most powerful object in the world, dear one.
Now there's a thought, Worgen said. Sparhawk could use Belium to obliterate whole chunks of Otha's army.
Incidentally, Sparhawk, you are going to return Belium to the Royal House of Thalesia when you're finished with it, aren't you?
We might discuss that, Your Majesty, Sparhawk said. It wouldn't really do you all that much good, though.
It won't do anything at all without the rings, and I don't feel much like surrendering mine yet. You can ask my queen how she feels about hers, if you wish.
My ring stays where it is, Elana said flatly.
Sparhawk had been mulling over his earlier conversation with Sophronia. He was growing increasingly certain that the impending confrontation was not going to be settled by vast armies clashing in central Lamarkand in the way that the one 500 years earlier had been. He had no way to justify his certainty, since he had not reached it by logic, but rather by some intuitive leap that was more styric in nature than a lean. He somehow knew that it would be a mistake for him to immerse himself in an army. Not only would that delay him in something he must do, but it would also be dangerous. If the subversion of Sir Perrine had not been an independent act on Martell's part, then he would be exposing himself and his friends to thousands of potential enemies, all completely unidentifiable, and all armed to the teeth. Once again he absolutely had to get clear of an Aline army. His idea grew more out of that necessity than out of any real conviction that it would work. "Is there enough power in Beliom to destroy Azash?" he asked Sophronia. He already knew the answer, of course, but he wanted her to confirm it for the others.
"What are you saying, Sparhawk?" she asked in a tone of profound shock. "You're talking about destroying a god. The whole world trembles at such a suggestion."
"I'm not raising the question to start a theological debate," he said. "Would Beliom be able to do it?"
"I don't know. No one's ever had the temerity even to suggest it before."
"Where is Azash most vulnerable?" he asked.
"Only in his confinement. The younger gods of Styricum chained him within that clay idol Otha found centuries ago. That's one of the reasons he's been seeking Beliom so desperately. Only the Sapphire Rose can free him."
"And if the idol were to be destroyed?"
"Azash would be destroyed with it."
"And what would happen if I went to the city of Zamok, discovered that I couldn't destroy Azash with Beliom, and smashed the jewel instead?"
"The city would be obliterated," she said in a troubled tone, "along with any mountain ranges in the vicinity."
"I can't really lose, then, can I? Either way, Azash ceases to exist. And if what Kroger told us is true, Oath is at Zamok as well, along with Martell, Anius, and various others. I could get them all. Once Azash and Otha are gone, the Zamok invasion would disintegrate, wouldn't it?"
"You're talking about throwing your life away, Sparhawk," Vanion said.
"Better one life than millions."
"I absolutely forbid it," Elana shouted.
"Forgive me, my queen," Sparhawk told her, "but you ordered me to deal with Anius and the others. You can't really rescind that command. At least not to me you can't."
There was a polite rap on the door, and Tinian entered with the Domi Crane. "Sorry to be late," the Deiran knight apologized. "The Domi and I have been busy with some maps. For some reason, the Zamoks have sent forces north from their main encampment on the Lamarck border. There's an infestation of them in eastern Pelosia."
Crane's eyes brightened when he saw King Soros.
"Ah, there you are, my king," he said. "I've been looking all over for you. I've got all sorts of Zamok ears I'd like to sell you."
King Soros whispered something. He still appeared to have a sore throat for some reason.
"It's starting to fit together," Sparhawk told the council. "Kroger told us that Martell was taking Anius to the city of Zamok to seek refuge with Otha."
He leaned back in his chair.
"I think the final solution to the problem we've been having for the last 5 centuries lies in the city of Zamok, and not on the plains of Lamarkand. Azash is our enemy, not Martell or Anius or Otha and his Zamoks. And we've got the means to destroy Azash once and for all in our hands right now. Wouldn't we be foolish not to use it? I could wear the petals off Beliom destroying Zamok infantry units with it, and we'd all grow old and gray on some fluid battlefield to the north of Lake Camoria. Wouldn't it be better to go right to the heart of the problem? To Azash himself? Let's have done with this, so that it doesn't keep cropping up every half eon or so."
"It's strategically unsound, Sparhawk," Vanion said flatly.
"Excuse me, my friend, but what's so strategically sound about a stalemate on a flat battlefield? It took more than a century to recover from the last battle between the Zamoks and the West. This way we at least have a chance to end it once and for all. If it appears not to be working, I'll destroy Beliom. Then Azash won't have any reason to come west again. He'll go pester the Tamils or something instead.
You'd never get through, Sparhawk, Preceptor Abriel said. You heard what this Piloi said. There are Zamoks in eastern Pelosia as well as the ones down in eastern Lamarkand. Do you propose to wade through them all by yourself?
I think they'll stand aside for me, my lord. Martell's going north, at least that's what he said. He may go as far north as Pollard, or he may not. It doesn't really matter, because I'm going to follow him no matter where he goes. He wants me to follow him. He made that fairly clear down in that cellar, and he was very careful to make sure that I heard him, because he wants to deliver me to Azash. I think I can trust him not to put anything in my way. I know it sounds a little peculiar, but I think we can actually trust Martell this time. If he really has to, he'll take his sword and clear a path for me. He smiled bleakly. My brother's tender concern for my welfare touches my heart. He looked at Sophronia. You said that even suggesting the destruction of a god is unthinkable, didn't you? What would be the general reaction to the idea of destroying Belium?
That's even more unthinkable, Sparhawk.
Then the notion that I might be considering it won't even occur to them, will it? She shook her head mutely, her eyes strangely frightened as she looked at him. That's our advantage, then, my lords, Sparhawk declared. I can do the one thing that no one can bring himself to believe that I'll do. I can destroy the Belium, or threaten to. Somehow I have the feeling that people and gods are going to start getting out of my way if I do that. Preceptor Abriel was still stubbornly shaking his head. You'll be trying to bull your way through primitive Zamoks in eastern Pelosia and along the border, Sparhawk. Not even Otha has control over those savages.
Permission to speak, Sarathi? Kring asked in a profoundly respectful tone.
Of course, my son. Dolmat looked a bit puzzled. He had no idea who this fierce man was. I can get you through eastern Pelosia and well into Zamok, friend Sparhawk, Kring said. If the Zamoks are all spread out, my horsemen can ride right through them. We'll leave a swath of bodies 5 miles wide from Pollard to the Zamok border, all minus their right ears, of course. Kring's broad grin was wolfish. He looked around in a self-congratulatory way. Then he saw Murtai, who sat demurely beside Alana. His eyes went wide, and he first went pale and then bright red. Then he sighed lustily. I wouldn't if I were you, Sparhawk warned him.
What?
I'll explain later.
I hate to admit it, Bavier said, but this plan's looking better and better. We really shouldn't have much trouble at all getting to Otha's capital.
We? Calton asked.
We were going to go along, weren't we, Calton?
Has it got any chance at all of working, little mother? Vanion asked.
No, Lord Vanion, it hasn't,
Alana interrupted him.
Sparhawk can't go to Zamok and use Belium to kill Azash because he doesn't have both rings. I've got one of them, and he'll have to kill me to get it away from me.
That was something Sparhawk had not considered. My queen, he began.
I have not given you leave to speak, Sir Sparhawk, she told him. You will not pursue this vain and foolhardy scheme. You will not throw your life away. Your life is mine, Sparhawk, mine. You do not have our permission to take it from us.
That's plain enough, Worgen said, and it takes us right back to where we started from.
Perhaps not, Dolmant said quietly.
He rose to his feet.
Queen Alana, he said sternly, will you submit to the will of our Holy Mother, the Church?
She looked at him defiantly.
Will you?
I am a true daughter of the Church, she said sullenly.
I'm delighted to hear it, my child. It is the command of the Church that you surrender this trinket into her hands for some brief time that she may use it in furtherance of her work.
That's not fair, Dolmant, she accused.
Will you defy the Church, Alana?
I can't, she wailed.
Then give me the ring.
He held out his hand.
Alana burst into tears. She clutched his arms and buried her face in his robe.
Give me the ring, Alana, he repeated.
She looked up at him, dashing the tears from her eyes with one defiant hand.
Only on one condition, Sarathi, she countered.
Will you try to bargain with our Holy Mother?
No, Sarathi. I am merely obeying one of her earlier commands. She instructs us to marry so that we may increase the congregation of the faithful. I will surrender the ring to you on the day you join me with Sir Sparhawk in marriage. I've worked too hard to get him to let him escape me now.
Will our Holy Mother consent to this?
It seems fair to me, Dolmant said, smiling benignly at Sparhawk, who was gaping at the two of them as he was traded off like a side of beef. Elana had a very good memory. As Platamy had instructed her, she spat in her hand.
Done, then, she said.
Dolmant had been around for a long time, so he recognized the gesture. He also spat on his palm.
Done,
he said, and the two of them smacked their palms together, sealing Sparhawk's fate. Part 3. Zamok. Chapter 19. The room was cool. The heat of the desert evaporated when the sun went down, and there was always an arid chill by morning. Sparhawk stood at the window as velvet night bled from the sky, and the shadows in the street below shrank back into corners and doorways to be replaced by a pale grayness that was not so much light as it was an absence of dark. Then the first of them emerged from a shadowy alley with a clay vessel balanced on her shoulder. She was robed and hooded in black, and a black veil covered the lower half of her face. She moved through the pale light with a grace so exquisite that it made Sparhawk's heart ache. Then there were others. One by one they emerged from doorways and alleys to join the silent procession, each with her clay vessel upon her shoulder, and each following a ritual so old that it had become instinctive. However it was that the men began their day, the women inevitably started theirs by going to the well. Lilius stirred.
Makra, she said in a voice slurred with sleep. Come back to bed.
He could hear the bells in the distance, even over the incessant bawling of the half-wild cows in the yards around him. The religion of this kingdom discouraged bells, so Sparhawk knew that the sound came from a place where members of his own faith were gathered. There was no other place to go, so he stumbled on toward the sound of the bells. The hilt of his sword was slippery with blood, and the weapon seemed very heavy now. He wanted to be free of its weight, and it would be so easy to let it slip from his fingers, to lie lost in the dung-smelling darkness. A true knight, however, surrendered his sword only to death, and Sparhawk grimly clamped his fist about the sword hilt and lurched on, following the bells. He was cold, and the blood flowing from his wounds seemed very warm, even comforting. He staggered on through the chill night with the blood flowing from one side, warming him. Sparhawk! It was Keurig's voice, and the hand shaking his shoulder was firm. Sparhawk, wake up! You're having a nightmare again. Sparhawk opened his eyes. He was sweating profusely.
The same one? Keurig asked.
Sparhawk nodded.
Maybe you'll be able to put it to rest when you finally kill Martell.
Sparhawk sat up in bed. Keurig's face was creased with a broad grin.
I thought it might have been a different one, he said. This is your wedding day, after all. Bridegrooms always have bad dreams on the night before their weddings. It's sort of an old custom.
Was your sleep uneasy the night before you married Asladi?
Oh, yes, Keurig laughed. Something was chasing me, and I had to get to a seacoast so I could get on board a ship to escape. The only problem was that they kept moving the ocean.
Do you want your breakfast now, or do you want to wait until after you've bathed and I shave you?
I can shave myself. That wouldn't be a good idea today. Hold out your hand.
Sparhawk extended his right hand. It was visibly trembling.
You definitely shouldn't try to shave yourself today, my lord. Let's call it my wedding present to the queen. I won't let you go to her bed on her wedding night with your face in tatters.
What time is it?
A half hour or so before dawn.
Get up, Sparhawk. You've got a full day ahead of you.
Oh, by the way, Elana sent you a present. It came last night after you fell asleep.
You should have got me up.
Why? You can't wear it in bed.
What is it?
Your crown, my lord. My what?
Crown. It's a sort of a hat. It won't keep off much in the way of weather, though.
What's she thinking about?
Propriety, my lord. You're the prince consort, or you will be by tonight. It's not a bad crown, as crowns go. Gold, jewels, that sort of thing.
Where did she get it?
She had it made for you right after you left Simmera to come here.
She brought it along with her. Sort of the way a fisherman always has a coil of line and a hook somewhere in his pocket.
I gather that your bride didn't want to be unprepared in case an opportunity arose. She wants me to carry it on a velvet cushion during the ceremony tonight. As soon as the two of you are married, she's going to put it on your head.
Foolishness, Sparhawk snorted, swinging his legs out of bed.
Perhaps, but you'll learn in time that women look at the world differently from the way we do. It's one of the things that makes life interesting. Now, what's it to be? Your breakfast or your bath?
They met that morning in the chapter house, since things in the basilica were in turmoil. The changes Dolmet was making were sweeping, and the clergy was scrambling about like ants rooted from a ripped-open anthill. The huge patriarch Bergston, still in his mail shirt and wearing his ogre-horned helmet, was grinning as he entered Sir Noshan's study and stood his war axe in the corner.
"Where's Emban?" King Worgen asked him.
"And Ortsel?"
"They're busy dismissing people. Sarathi's giving the basilica a thorough house-cleaning. Emban's drawn up a list of the politically unreliable, and the populations of a number of monasteries are expanding sharply."
"Makova?" Tinian asked.
"He was among the first to leave."
"Who's first secretary?" King Dragos asked.
"Who else? Emban, of course. And Ortsel's the new head of the College of Theologians. It's probably what he's best suited for, anyway."
"And you?" Worgen asked him.
"Sarathi's given me a rather specialized position," Bergston replied. "We haven't come up with a name for it as yet."
He looked rather sternly at the preceptors of the Church Knights.
"There's been some rather long-standing dissension among the militant orders," he told them. "Sarathi's asked me to put a stop to it."
His shaggy brows lowered ominously.
"I trust we understand each other, gentlemen."
The preceptors looked at each other a bit nervously. "Now," Bergston continued,
"have we made any decisions here yet?"
"We are still arguing about that, Your Grace," Vanyon answered. Vanyon's face was gray this morning for some reason, and he looked definitely unwell. Sparhawk sometimes forgot that Vanyon was quite a bit older than he looked. "Sparhawk's still bent on suicide, and we haven't been able to come up with any convincing alternatives. The rest of the Church Knights are going to move out tomorrow to occupy various fortresses and castles in Lamarkand, and the army will follow once they've been organized."
Bergston nodded.
"Exactly what are you going to do, Sparhawk?"
"I thought I'd go destroy Azash, kill Martell, Otha, and Anius, and then come home, Your Grace."
"Very funny," Bergston said dryly. "Details, man, give me details. I have to make a report to Sarathi, and he loves details."
"Yes, Your Grace. We've all more or less agreed that we don't have much chance of catching up with Martell and his party before they get across into Zamok. He's got a 3-day start on us, counting today. Martell isn't very considerate of horses, and he has a lot of incentive to stay ahead of us. Are you going to follow him, or just ride straight on to the Zamok border?"
Sparhawk leaned back in his chair.
"We're a little tenuous on that, Your Grace," he said thoughtfully. "I'd like to catch Martell, certainly, but I'm not going to let that sidetrack me. My main goal is to get to the city of Zamok before a general war breaks out in central Lamarkand. I had a talk with Kroger, and he says that Martell plans to go north and then to try to cross over into Zamok from somewhere up in Pelosia. I more or less want to do the same thing, so I'll follow him, but only up to a point. I'm not going to waste time chasing Martell all over northern Pelosia. If he starts wandering around up there, I'll break off the chase and go straight on to Zamok. I've been playing Martell's game ever since I came back from Rendor. I don't think I want to play any more."
"What are you going to do about all the Zamoks in eastern Pelosia?"
"That's where I come in, Your Grace," Kring told him. "There's a pass that leads into the interior. The Zamoks don't seem to know about it for some reason. My horsemen and I have been using it for years, any time ears get scarce along the border." He stopped abruptly and looked with some consternation at King Soros. The king of Piloja, however, was busy praying and appeared not to have heard the Domi's inadvertent revelation. "That's about all there is to it, Your Grace," Sparhawk concluded. "Nobody really knows for sure what's going on in Zamok, so we'll have to improvise once we get there." "How many of you are there?" Bergsten asked. "The usual group. 5 knights, Curic, Bayrit, and Sophrenia."
"What about me?"
Talon objected.
"You are going back to Simera, young man," Sophrenia told him. "Elana can keep an eye on you. You'll stay at the palace until we come back."
"That's not fair."
"Life is filled with injustice, Talon. Sparhawk and your father have plans for you, and they don't propose to let you get yourself killed before they have a chance to put them in motion."
"Can I appeal to the church for sanctuary, Your Grace?"
Talon asked Bergsten quickly.
"No, I don't think so," the armored patriarch replied.
"You have no idea how disappointed I am in our Holy Mother, Your Grace," Talon sulked. "Just for that, I don't think I'll join the church after all."
"Praise God," Bergsten murmured.
"Amen," Abriel sighed.
"May I be excused?"
Talon asked in a huffy tone.
"No."
It was Bayrut who sat by the door with his arms crossed and one leg thrust out to block the doorway. Talon sat back down, looking injured. The remainder of the discussion dealt with the deployment of troops at the various fortresses and castles in central Lamarkand. Sparhawk and his friends were not going to be involved in that, so the bridegroom's attention wandered. He did not actually think of anything very coherently, but sat instead staring wide-eyed at the floor. The meeting broke up about noon, and they began to file out. There were many preparations to make, and they all had things to do.
"Friend Sparhawk," Kring said as they left Nashan's study, "might I have a word with you?"
"Of course, Domi."
"It's sort of personal."
Sparhawk nodded, and led the scarred chief of the Piloi to a small chapel nearby. They both perfunctorily genuflected to the altar and then sat on a polished bench near the front of the chapel.
"What is it, Kring?" Sparhawk asked.
"I'm a plain man, friend Sparhawk," Kring began, "so I'll speak to the point. I'm mightily taken with that tall, beautiful woman who guards the Queen of Elenia."
"I thought I detected something like that."
"Do you think I might have any chance with her at all?"
Kring's heart was in his eyes.
"I'm not really sure, my friend," Sparhawk told him. "I scarcely know Murtai."
"Is that her name? I never really had the chance to find out."
"Murtai.
It's got a nice sound to it, doesn't it? Everything about her is perfect.
I have to ask this. Is she married?"
"I don't think so."
"Good. It's always awkward to pay court to a woman if you have to kill her husband first. It seems to get things off to a bad start for some reason."
"I think you should know that Murtai is not an Aline, Kring. She's a Tamil, and her culture and religion are not the same as ours. Are your intentions honorable?"
"Of course. I think too much of her to insult her."
"That's the first step, anyway. If you approached her on any other footing, she'd probably kill you."
"Kill?"
Kring blinked in astonishment.
"She's a warrior, Kring. She's not like any other woman you've ever encountered."
"Women can't be warriors."
"Not Aline women, no. But as I said, Murtai is an Atan Tamil. They don't look at the world the same way we do. As I understand it, she's already killed 10 men."
10?
Kring gasped incredulously, swallowing hard.
"That's going to be a problem, Sparhawk."
Kring squared his shoulders.
"No matter, though. Perhaps after I marry her, I can train her to behave more properly."
"I wouldn't make any wagers on that, my friend. If there's going to be any training, I think you're the one who'll be on the receiving end of it."
"I'd really advise you to drop the whole idea, Kring. I like you, and I'd hate to see you get yourself killed."
"I'm going to have to think about this, Sparhawk," Kring said in a disturbed tone of voice. "This is a very unnatural situation we have here."
"Yes."
"Nonetheless, could I ask you to serve as my Oma?"
"I don't understand the word."
"It means friend, the one who goes to the woman and to her father and brothers. You start by telling her how much I'm attracted to her, and then tell her what a good man I am. The usual thing, you understand. What a great leader I am, how many horses I own, how many ears I've taken, and what a great warrior I am."
"That last should impress her."
"It's just the simple truth, Sparhawk," I am the best, after all. I'll have all the time while we're riding to Zamok to think it over. You might mention it to her before we leave, though, just to give her something to think about. Oh, I almost forgot. You can tell her that I'm a poet, too. That always impresses women.
I'll do my best, Domi, Sparhawk promised. Murtai's reaction was none too promising when Sparhawk broached the subject to her later that afternoon.
That little bald one with the bandy legs, she said incredulously. The one with all the scars on his face.
Then she collapsed in a chair, laughing uncontrollably.
Well, Sparhawk murmured philosophically as he left her, I tried.
It was going to be an unconventional sort of wedding. There were no Elanian noblewomen in Kyrelos to attend Alana, for one thing. The only two ladies who were really close to her were Sophrenia and Murtai. She insisted on their presence, and that raised some eyebrows. Even the worldly Dolmat choked on it.
You can't bring two heathens into the nave of the basilica during a religious ceremony, Alana.
It's my wedding, Dolmat. I can do anything I want to. I will have Sophrenia and Murtai as attendants.
I forbid it.
Fine. Her eyes grew flinty. No attendance, no wedding. And if there isn't a wedding, my ring stays right where it is.
That is an impossible young woman, Sparhawk, the archprelate fumed as he stormed out of the room where Alana was making her preparations.
We prefer the term spirited, Sarathi, Sparhawk said mildly. Sparhawk was dressed in black velvet trimmed with silver. Alana had summarily rejected the idea of his being married in his armor.
I don't want a blacksmith in our bedchamber to help you get undressed, love, she had told him. If you need help, I'll provide it, but I don't want to break all my fingernails in the process.
There were noblemen by the score in the armies of Western Aeosia, and legions of clergy in the basilica. And so that evening the vast candlelit nave was almost as packed as it had been on the day of the funeral of the revered Clavonus. The choir sang joyful anthems as the wedding guests filed in, and incense by the bale perfumed the air. Sparhawk waited nervously in the vestry, with those who were to attend him. His friends were all there, of course, Calton, Tinian, Bavier, Euleth, and the Domi, as well as Curic, Beirut, and the preceptors of the four orders. Elana's attendants, appropriately, were, in addition to Sophrenia and Murtai, the kings of Western Aeosia, and, oddly enough, Platami, Strogon, and Talon. The queen had given no reason for these selections. It was altogether possible that there were no reasons.
Don't do that, Sparhawk, Curic told his lord.
Do what?
Don't keep pulling at the neck of your doublet like that. You'll rip it.
That tailor cut it too tight. It feels like a noose. Curic did not answer that. He did, however, give Sparhawk an amused look. The door opened, and Emban thrust his sweating face into the room. He was grinning broadly.
Are we just about ready? He asked.
Let's get on with it, Sparhawk said abruptly.
Our bridegroom grows impatient, I see, Emban said. Ah, to be young again. The choir's going to sing the traditional wedding hymn, he told them. I'm sure that some of you are familiar with it. When they get to the final chord, I'll open the door, and then you gentlemen can escort our sacrificial lamb here to the altar. Please don't let him run away. That always disrupts the ceremony so much. He chuckled wickedly and closed the door again.
That's a very nasty little man, Sparhawk grated.
Oh, I don't know, Calton said. I sort of like him.
The wedding hymn was one of the oldest pieces of sacred music in the Aline faith. It was a song filled with joy. Brides traditionally paid very close attention to it. Grooms, on the other hand, usually scarcely heard it. As the last notes died away, Patriarch Emban opened the door with a flourish, and Sparhawk's friends formed up around him to escort him into the nave. It would be perhaps inappropriate here to dwell upon the similarities of such a procession to the gathering of bailiffs escorting a condemned prisoner to the scaffold. They proceeded directly across the front of the nave to the altar, where Archprelate Dolmant, robed all in white trimmed with gold, awaited them.
Ah, my son, Dolmant said to Sparhawk with a faint smile, so good of you to join us.
Sparhawk did not trust himself to answer that. He did, however, reflect rather bitterly on the fact that all his friends viewed the occasion as one filled with an enormous potential for humor.
Then, after a suitable pause, during which all the wedding guests rose to their feet, fell silent, and craned their necks to gaze toward the back of the nave, the choir broke into the processional hymn, and the bridal party emerged from either side of the vestibule. First, one from either side, came Sophronia and Mirtai. The disparity of the size of the two women was not immediately noted by the onlookers. What was noted, and what raised a shocked gasp from the crowd, was the obvious fact that both were clearly heathens. Sophronia's white robe was almost defiantly styric. A garland of flowers encircled her brow, and her face was calm. Mirtai's gown was of a style unknown in Alania. It was of a deep royal blue, and seemed to be unseamed. It was fastened at each shoulder with a jeweled clip, and a long gold chain caught it below the bust, crossed the Tamil woman's back, and circled her waist, and then hugged her hips to the intricate knot low in the front with the tasseled ends nearly reaching the floor. Her golden arms were bare to the shoulders, flawlessly smooth yet solidly muscled. She wore golden sandals, and her now unbraided and glossy black hair flowed smoothly down her back, reaching to mid-thigh. A simple silver band encircled her head. About her wrists she wore not bracelets, but rather burnished steel cuffs embossed with gold. As a concession to Aline's sensibilities, she was not visibly armed. The Domi Kring sighed lustily as she entered, and, with Sophronia at her side, paced slowly down the aisle toward the altar. Again there was the customary pause, and then the bride, her left hand resting lightly on the arm of old King Obler, emerged from the vestibule to stop so that all present might view her, not so much as a woman, but as a work of art. Her gown was of white satin, but brides are almost always gowned in white satin. This particular gown was lined with gold lamé, and the long sleeves were turned back to reveal that contrast. The sleeves themselves were cut long at the backs of the arms, reaching quite nearly to the floor. Elana wore a wide belt of beaten mesh gold inlaid with precious gems about her waist. A fabulous golden cape descended to the floor behind her to add its weight to her gleaming satin train. Her pale blonde hair was surmounted by a crown, not the traditional royal crown of Elania, but rather a lacework of gold mesh, highlighted with small, brightly colored gems interspersed with pearls. The crown held her veil in place, a veil that reached to her bodice in the front and overlaid her shoulders in the back, and was so delicate and fine as to be scarcely more than mist. She carried a single white flower, and her pale young face was radiant. "Where did they get the gowns on such short notice?" Beirut whispered to Curic. "Sophronia wriggled her fingers, I'd imagine." Dolmant gave the two of them a stern look, and they stopped whispering. After the Queen of Elania there came the crowned kings Worgen, Dragos, and Soros, and the crowned prince of Lamarkand, who was standing in for his absent father, followed by the ambassador of Camoria, who was the representative of that kingdom. The kingdom of Rendor was unrepresented, and no one had even thought to invite Otha of Zamok. The procession began to move slowly down the aisle toward the altar and the waiting bridegroom. Platami and Stragan brought up the rear, one of them on each side of Talon, who bore the white velvet cushion upon which rested that pair of ruby rings. It should be noted in passing that both Stragan and Platami were keeping a very close eye on the youthful thief. Sparhawk considered his bride as with glowing face she approached. In those last few moments while he was still able to think coherently, he realized something at last that he had never fully admitted to himself. Elana had been a chore when she had been placed in his care years ago, not only a chore but a humiliation as well. It is to his credit that he had felt no personal resentment toward her, for he had realized that she had been as much a victim of her father's caprice as he was himself. The first year and more had been trying. The girl child who now so radiantly approached him had been timorous, and at first had spoken only to Rollo, a small, somewhat bedraggled, stuffed toy animal that in those days was her constant and probably only companion. In time, however, she had grown accustomed to Sparhawk's battered face and stern demeanor, and a somewhat tenuous friendship had been cemented on the day when an arrogant courtier had offered Princess Alana an impertinence, and had been firmly rebuked by her knight protector. It was undoubtedly the first time anyone had ever shed blood for her. The courtier's nose had bled profusely, and an entire new world had opened for the small, pale princess. From that moment, she had confided everything to her knight, even things he might have preferred she had not. She had no secrets from him, and he had come to know her as he had never known anyone else in the world. And that, of course, had ruined him for any other woman. The slight, as yet unformed, princess had so intricately intertwined her very being with his that there was no possible way they could ever truly be separated. And that, finally, was why they were here in this place at this time. If there had been only his own pain to consider, Sparhawk might have held firm in his rejection of the idea. He could not, however, endure her pain, and so... The hymn concluded. Old King Obler delivered his kinswoman to her knight, and the bride and groom turned to face Archprelate Dolmant. "I'm going to preach to you for a while," Dolmant told them quietly. "It's a sort of convention, and people expect me to do it. You don't really have to listen, but try not to yawn in my face if you can avoid it." "We wouldn't dream of it, Sarathi," Elana assured him. Dolmant spoke of the state of marriage at some length. He then assured the bridal couple that once the ceremony had been completed, it would be perfectly all right for them to follow their natural inclinations, that it would not only be all right, but was in fact encouraged. He strongly suggested that they be faithful to each other and reminded them that any issue of their union must be raised in the Elanian faith. Then he came to the Wiltthous, asking them in turn if they consented to be wed, bestowed all their worldly goods upon each other, and promised to love, honor, obey, cherish, and so forth. Then, since things were going so well, he moved right along into the exchanging of the rings, neither of which Talon had even managed to steal. It was at that point that Sparhawk heard a soft, familiar sound that seemed to echo down from the dome itself. It was the faint trilling of pipes, a joyful sound filled with abiding love. Sparhawk glanced at Sophronia. Her glowing smile said everything. For a moment, he irrationally wondered what protocols had been involved when Afrael had applied to the Aline god for permission to be present, and it appeared to add her blessing to his. "What is that music?" Elana whispered, her lips not moving. "I'll explain later," Sparhawk murmured. The song of Afrael's pipes seemed to go unnoticed by the throng in the candlelit nave. Dolmant's eyes, however, widened slightly, and his face went a bit pale. He regained his composure and finally declared that Sparhawk and Elana were permanently, irrevocably, unalterably, and definitively man and wife. He then invoked the blessings of God upon them in a nice little concluding prayer, and finally gave Sparhawk permission to kiss his bride. Sparhawk tenderly lifted Elana's veil and touched his lips to hers. No one actually kisses someone else very well in public, but the couple managed without looking too awkward about the whole business. The wedding ceremony was followed immediately by Sparhawk's coronation as prince consort. He knelt to have the crown Curic had carried into the nave on a purple velvet cushion placed upon his head by the young woman who had just promised, among other things, to obey him, but who now assumed the authority of his queen. Elana made a nice speech in a ringing voice with which she could probably have commanded rocks to move, with some fair expectation of being obeyed. She said a number of things about him in her speech, mostly flattering, and concluded by firmly settling the crown on his head. Then, since he was on his knees anyway and his upturned face was convenient, she kissed him again. He noticed that she got much, much better at it with practice. "You're mine now, Sparhawk," she murmured with her lips still touching his. Then, though he was far from decrepit, she helped him to his feet. Murtai and Calton came forward with ermine-trimmed robes to place on the shoulders of the royal pair, and then the two of them turned to receive the cheers of the throng within the nave. There was a wedding supper following the ceremony. Sparhawk never remembered what was served at that supper, nor even if he ate any of it. All he remembered was that it seemed to go on for centuries. Then at last he and his bride were escorted to the door of a lavish chamber high up in the east wing of one of the buildings that comprised the church complex. He and Elana entered, and he closed and locked the door behind them. There were furnishings in the room, chairs, tables, divans, and the like. But all Sparhawk really saw was the stark reality of the bed. It was a high bed on a raised dais, and it had a substantial post at each corner. "Finally," Elana said with relief. "I thought all of that was going to go on forever." "Yes," Sparhawk agreed. "Sparhawk," she said then, and her tone was not the tone of a queen. "Do you really love me? I know I forced you into this, first back in Simmera and then here. Did you marry me because you really love me? Or did you just defer to me because I'm the queen?" Her voice was trembling and her eyes were very vulnerable.
"You're asking silly questions, Alana," he told her gently. "I'll admit that you startled me at first, probably because I had no idea that you felt this way. I'm not much of a catch, Alana, but I do love you. I've never loved anyone else, and never will. My heart's a little battered, but it's entirely yours."
Then he kissed her, and she seemed to melt against him.
The kiss lasted for quite some time, and after a few moments he felt one small hand slide caressingly up the back of his neck to remove his crown. He drew his face back and looked into her lustrous gray eyes. Then he gently removed her crown and let her veil slide to the floor. Gravely, each unfastened the other's ermine-trimmed robe and let it fall. The window was open, and the night breeze billowed the gauzy curtains and carried with it the nighttime sounds of Kyrillos far below. Sparhawk and Alana did not feel the breeze, and the only sound they heard was the beating of each other's hearts. The candles no longer burned, but the room was not dark. The moon had risen, a full moon that filled the night with a pale, silvery luminescence. The moonlight seemed caught in the filmy net of the curtains blowing softly at the window, and the glow of those curtains provided a subtler, more perfect light than that of any candle. It was very late, or, to be more precise, very early. Sparhawk had dozed off briefly, but his pale, moon-drenched wife shook him awake. "None of that," she told him. "We only have this one night, and you're not going to waste it by sleeping." "Sorry," he apologized. "I've had a busy day. Also a busy night," she added with an arch little smile. "Did you know that you snore like a thunderstorm? It's the broken nose, I think."
"That may cause problems in time, love. I'm a light sleeper." Alana nestled down in his arms and sighed contentedly. "Oh, this is very nice," she said. "We should have gotten married years ago."
"I think your father might have objected, and if he hadn't, Rollo certainly would have. Whatever happened to Rollo, by the way?"
"His stuffings all came out after my father sent you into exile. I washed him and then folded him up and put him on the top shelf in my closet. I'll have him restuffed after our first baby is born."
"Poor Rollo. He saw some hard use after you were sent away. I cried all over him extensively. He was a very soggy little animal for several months." "Did you really miss me all that much?"
"Miss you? I thought I'd die. I wanted to die, actually."
His arms tightened around her.
"Well, now," she said, "why don't we talk about that?"
He laughed. "Do you absolutely have to say everything that pops into your head?"
"When we're alone, yes. I have no secrets from you, my husband."
She remembered something.
"You said you were going to tell me about that music we heard during the ceremony."
"That was Afrael. I'll have to check with Sophronia, but I rather strongly suspect that we've been married in more than one religion."
"Good. That gives me another hold on you."
"You don't really need any more, you know. You've had me in thrall since you were about 6 years old."
"That's nice," she said, snuggling even closer to him. "God knows I was trying." She paused. "I must say, though, that I'm getting just a bit put out with your impertinent little Styric goddess. She always seems to be around. For all we know, she's hovering unseen in some corner right now."
She stopped suddenly and sat up in bed.
"Do you suppose she might be?" she asked with some consternation.
"I wouldn't be surprised." He was deliberately teasing her.
"Sparhawk!" The pale light of the moon made it impossible to be sure, but Sparhawk strongly suspected that his wife was blushing furiously.
"Don't concern yourself, love," he laughed. "Afriel's exquisitely courteous. She'd never think of intruding."
"But we can never really be sure, can we?" I'm not sure I like her. I get the feeling that she's very much attracted to you, and I don't much care for the notion of immortal competition. Don't be absurd. She's a child. I was only about 5 years old the first time I saw you, Sparhawk, and I decided to marry you the minute you walked into the room. She slid from the bed, crossed to the glowing window, and parted the gauzy curtains. The pale moonlight made her look very much like an alabaster statue.
"Shouldn't you put on a robe?" he suggested. "You're exposing yourself to public scrutiny, you know.
Everybody in Kyrillos has been asleep for hours now. Besides, we're 6 floors above the street. I want to look at the moon. The moon and I are very close, and I want her to know how happy I am."
"Pagan," he smiled.
"I suppose I am at that," she admitted. "But all women feel a peculiar attachment to the moon. She touches us in ways a man could never understand."
Sparhawk crawled out of bed and joined her at the window.
The moon was very pale and very bright, but the fact that its pale light washed out all color concealed to some degree the ruin Martell's siege had inflicted on the holy city, although the smell of smoke was still very strong in the night air. The stars glittered in the sky. There was nothing really unusual about that, but they seemed especially brilliant on this night of all nights.
Elana pulled his arms about her and sighed. "I wonder if Murtai is sleeping outside my door," she said. "She does that, you know. Wasn't she ravishing tonight?" "Oh, yes. I didn't get the chance to tell you this, but Kring's completely overwhelmed by her. I've never seen a man so bowled over by love."
"At least he's open and honest about it. I have to drag affectionate words out of you."
"You know that I love you, Elana. I always have."
"That's not precisely true. When I was still carrying Rollo around, you were only mildly fond of me."
"It was more than that."
"Oh, really? I saw the pained looks you used to give me when I was being childish and silly, my noble prince consort."
She frowned.
"That's a very cumbersome title. When I get back to Simera, I think I'll have a talk with Lenda. It seems to me there's an empty duchy somewhere. Or if there isn't, I'll vacate one. I'm going to dispossess a few of Annie's henchmen anyway. How would you like to be a duke, Your Grace?"
"Thanks all the same, Your Majesty, but I think I can forego the encumbrance of additional titles."
"But I want to give you titles."
"I'm sort of taken with husband, personally."
"Any man can be a husband.
But I'm the only one who's yours."
"Oh, that's very nice. Practice a bit, Sparhawk, and you might even turn into a perfect gentleman."
"Most of the perfect gentlemen I know are courtiers. They're not generally held in high regard." She shivered.
"You're cold," he accused. "I told you to put on a robe." "Why do I need a robe when I have this nice warm husband handy?"
He bent, picked her up in his arms, and carried her back to the bed.
"I've dreamed of this," she said as he gently put her on the bed, joined her, and drew the covers over them. "You know something, Sparhawk?" She snuggled down against him again. "I used to worry about this night. I thought I'd be all nervous and shy, but I'm not at all. And do you know why?"
"No, I don't think so."
"I think it's because we've really been married since the first moment I laid my eyes on you. All we were really doing was waiting for me to grow up so that we could formalize things."
She kissed him lingeringly.
"What time do you think it is?"
"A couple of hours until daylight."
"Good. That gives us lots more time. You are going to be careful in Zamok, aren't you?"
"I'm going to do my best."
"Please don't do heroic things just to impress me, Sparhawk. I'm already impressed."
"I'll be careful," he promised.
"Speaking of that, do you want my ring now?"
"Why don't you give it to me in public? Let Sarathi see us keep our part of the bargain."
Was I really too terrible to him?
"You startled him a bit. Sarathi's not used to dealing with women like you. I think you unnerve him, my love."
"Do I unnerve you too, Sparhawk?"
"Not really. I raised you, after all. I'm used to your little quirks."
"You're really lucky, you know. Very few men have the opportunity to rear their own wives. That may give you something to think about on your way to Zamok."
Her voice quavered then, and a sudden sob escaped her.
"I swore I wouldn't do this," she wailed. "I don't want you to remember me as being all weepy." It's all right, Alala. I sort of feel the same way myself.
Why does the night have to run so fast?
Could this Afrail of yours stop the sun from coming up if we asked it to? Or maybe you could do it with the Belium.
I don't think anything in the world has the power to do that, Alala.
What good are they all, then?
She began to cry, and he took her into his arms and held her until the storm of her weeping had passed. Then he gently kissed her.
One kiss became several, and the rest of the night passed without any further weeping.
Chapter 20
But why does it have to be in public? Sparhawk demanded, clanking around the room to settle his armor into place.
It's expected, dear, Elana replied calmly. You're a member of the royal family now, and you're obliged to appear in public on occasion. You get used to it after a while.
Elana, wearing a fur-trimmed blue velvet robe, sat at her dressing table.
It's no worse than a tournament, my lord, Curic told him. That's in public, too. Now, will you stop pacing around so I can get your sword belt on straight?
Curic, Sophrenia, and Murtai had arrived at the bridal chamber with the sun, Curic carrying Sparhawk's armor, Sophrenia carrying flowers for the queen, and Murtai carrying breakfast. Emban came with them, and he carried the news that the formal farewell would take place on the steps of the basilica.
We haven't given the people or Worgen's troops much in the way of detail, Sparhawk, the fat little churchman cautioned, so you probably shouldn't get too specific if you start making speeches. We'll give you a rousing send-off and hint at the fact that you're going to save the world all by yourself. We're used to lying, so we'll even be able to sound convincing. It's all very silly, of course, but we'd appreciate your cooperation. The morale of the citizens, and particularly of Worgen's troops, is very important just now.
His round face took on a slightly disappointed cast.
I suggested that we have you do something spectacular in the way of magic to top things off, but Sarathi put his foot down.
Your tendency toward theatrics sometimes gets out of hand, Emban, Sophrenia told him.
The small Styric woman was toying with Alana's hair, experimenting with comb and brush.
I'm a man of the people, Sophrenia, Emban replied. My father was a tavern keeper, and I know how to please a crowd. The people love a good show, and that's what I wanted to give them.
Sophrenia had lifted Alana's hair into a mass atop the queen's head.
What do you think, Murtai? She asked.
I liked it the way it was before, the giantess replied.
She's married now. The way she wore her hair before was the way a young girl would wear it. We have to do something with it to indicate that she's a married woman.
Brand her, Murtai shrugged. That's what my people do. Do what?
Elana exclaimed.
Among my people, a woman is branded with her husband's mark when she marries, usually on the shoulder.
To indicate that she's his property? The queen asked scornfully. What sort of mark does the husband wear?
He wears his wife's mark. Marriages are not undertaken lightly among my people.
I can see why, Curic said with a certain awe.
Eat your breakfast before it gets cold, Elana, Murtai commanded.
I don't really care all that much for fried liver, Murtai.
It's not for you. My people lay some importance on the wedding night. Many brides became pregnant on that night, or so they say. That might be the result of practicing before the ceremony, though.
Murtai,
Elana gasped, flushing.
You mean you didn't? I'm disappointed in you.
I didn't think of it, Elana confessed.
Why didn't you say something, Sparhawk?
Emban, for some reason, was blushing furiously.
"Why don't I just run along?" he said. "I have a million things to take care of,"
and he bolted from the room.
"Was it something I said?" Murtai asked innocently.
"Emban's a churchman, dear," Sophrenia told her, trying to stifle a laugh.
"Churchmen prefer not to know too much about such things."
"Foolishness. Eat, Elana."
The gathering on the steps of the basilica was not quite a ceremony, but rather one of those informally formal affairs customarily put on for public entertainment. Dolmet was there to lend solemnity to the affair. The kings, crowned and robed, were present to give an official tone, and the preceptors of the militant orders to add a martial note. Dolmet began things with a prayer. That was followed by brief remarks from the kings, and then by slightly longer ones from the preceptors. Sparhawk and his companions then knelt to receive the archprelate's blessing, and the whole affair was concluded by the farewell between Elana and her prince consort.
The Queen of Elenia, speaking once again in that oratorical tone, commanded her champion to go forth and conquer. She concluded by removing her ring and bestowing it upon him as a mark of her special favor. He responded by replacing it upon her hand with a ring surmounted with a heart-shaped diamond. Talon had been a bit evasive about how the ring had come into his possession when he had pressed it upon Sparhawk just prior to the gathering on the steps. "And now, my champion," Elana concluded, perhaps a bit dramatically, "go forth with your brave companions, and know that our hopes, our prayers, and all our faith ride with you. Take up the sword, my husband and champion, and defend me and our faith and our beloved homes against the vile hordes of heathen Zamok." And then she embraced him, and bestowed a single brief kiss upon his lips. "Nice speech, love," he murmured his congratulations. "Emben wrote it," she confessed. "He's got the soul of a meddler. Try to get a word to me now and then, my husband. And in the name of God, be careful." He gently kissed her forehead. And then he and his friends strode purposefully to the foot of the marble stairs and their waiting horses, as the bells of the basilica rang out their own farewell. The preceptors of the militant orders who were to ride out with them a ways followed. Kring and his mounted piloi were already waiting in the street. Before they set out, Kring rode forward to where Murtai stood, and his horse performed that ritual genuflection to her. Neither of them spoke, but Murtai did look slightly impressed. "All right, Farron," Sparhawk said as he swung up into the saddle. "It's all right for you to indulge yourself just a bit." The big ugly roan's ears pricked forward eagerly, and he began to prance outrageously as the warlike party moved off in the direction of the east gate. Once they had passed the gate, Vanion left Sophrenia's side and drew his horse in beside Farron. "Stay alert, my friend," he advised. "Have you got Belion where you can get your hands on it in a hurry if you have to?" "It's inside my surcoat," Sparhawk said. He looked closely at his friend. "Don't take this wrong," he said, "but you're looking decidedly seedy this morning." "I'm tired more than anything, Sparhawk. Worgen kept us running pretty hard down there in Arsham. Take care of yourself, my friend. I want to go talk with Sophrenia before we separate." Sparhawk sighed as Vanion rode back along the column to rejoin the small, beautiful woman who had tutored generations of Pandions in the secrets of Styricum. Sophrenia and Vanion would never say anything overtly, even to each other. But Sparhawk knew how things stood between them, and he also knew how totally impossible their situation was. Calton pulled in beside him. "Well, how did the wedding night go?" he asked, his eyes very bright. Sparhawk gave him a long, flat look. "You don't want to talk about it, I gather." "It's sort of private." "We've been friends since boyhood, Sparhawk. We've never had any secrets from each other." "We have now." "It's about 70 leagues to Kadok, isn't it?" "That's fairly close. If we push, we should be able to make it in 5 days." "Did Martell sound at all concerned when he was talking with Aeneas down in that cellar?" "What I'm getting at is, do you think he'll be worried enough about our following him to hurry right along?"
"He definitely wanted to leave Kyrelos."
"He's probably pushing his horses hard then, wouldn't you say?"
"That's a safe bet."
"His horses will tire if he runs them hard. So we still might have a chance to catch up with him after a few days.
I don't know how you feel about him, but I'd certainly like to catch Addis."
"It's something to think about, all right.
How's the country between Kadok and Moterra?"
"Flat. Mostly farmland. Castles here and there. Farm villages.
It's a great deal like eastern Elenia."
Calton laughed.
"Have you taken a look at Bayrit this morning? He's having a little trouble adjusting to his armor. It doesn't fit him all that well."
Bayrit, the raw-boned young novice, had been promoted to a rank seldom used by the militant orders. He was now an apprentice knight, rather than a novice. This legally enabled him to wear his own armor, but he did not as yet rate a sir.
"He'll get used to it," Sparhawk said. "When we stop for the night, take him aside and show him how to pad the raw spots. We don't want him to start bleeding out of the joints of his armor. Be discreet about it, though. If I remember rightly, a young fellow's very proud and a little touchy when he first puts his armor on. That sort of passes after the first few blisters break."
It was when they reached a hilltop several miles from Kyrelos that the preceptors turned back. The advice and the cautions had all been given,
and so there was little to do but clasp hands and to wish each other well. Sparhawk and his friends rather soberly watched as their leaders rode back to the holy city.
"Well," Tinian said, "now that we're alone, let's talk for a few moments first," Sparhawk said. He raised his voice. "Domi," he called, "would you join us for a moment, please?"
Kring rode up the hill, an inquiring look on his face.
"Now then," Sparhawk began, "Martell seems to think that Azash will want us to get through without any difficulty. But Martell might be wrong. Azash has many servants, and he may very well loose them on us. He wants Belium, not any satisfaction he might get from a personal confrontation. Kring, I think you'd better put out scouts. Let's not be taken by surprise."
"I will, friend Sparhawk," the Domi promised.
"If we should happen to encounter any of the servants of Azash, I want all of you to fall back and let me deal with them. I've got Belium, and that should be all the advantage I'll need." Calton raised the point that we might just overtake Martell. "If we do, try to take Martell and Annius alive. The Church wants them to stand trial. I doubt that Orisa or Lycaeus will offer much resistance, so take them as well."
"And Addis?" Calton asked eagerly.
"Addis can barely talk, so he wouldn't be of much value in any trial. You can have him, as a personal gift from me." They had gone perhaps another mile when they found Stragon sitting under a tree. "I thought perhaps you'd gotten lost," the slender thief drawled, rising to his feet.
"Do I sense a volunteer here?" Tinian suggested.
"Hardly, old boy," Stragon said. "I've never had occasion to visit Zemok, and I think I want to keep it that way. Actually, I'm here as the Queen's messenger and her personal envoy. I'll ride along with you as far as the Zemok border, if I may, and then I'll return to Simra to give her my report." "Aren't you spending a great deal of time away from your own business?" Kyurik asked him.
"My business in Emsat sort of runs itself. Tell's looking out for my interests there. I need a vacation anyway."
He patted at his doublet in various places.
"Oh, yes, here it is." He drew out a folded sheet of parchment. "A letter for you from your bride, Sparhawk," he said, handing it over. "It's the first of several I'm supposed to give you when the occasion dictates."
Sparhawk moved Farron away from the others and broke the seal on Alana's note.
"Beloved, you've been gone for only a few hours, and I already miss you desperately. Stragon is carrying other messages for you, messages that I hope will inspire you when things aren't going well. They will also convey to you my unbending love and faith in you. I love you, my Sparhawk. Elana."
"How did you get ahead of us?" Calton was asking when Sparhawk rejoined them.
"You're wearing armor, Sir Calton," Stragon replied, "and I'm not. You'd be amazed at how fast a horse can run when he's not burdened with all that excess iron."
"Well?"
Euloth asked Sparhawk. "Do we send him back to Kyrelos?"
Sparhawk shook his head.
"He's acting under orders from the Queen. There's an implicit command to me involved in that as well. He comes along."
"Remind me never to become a royal champion," the Genidian knight said. "It seems to involve all sorts of politics and complications."
The weather turned cloudy as they rode northeasterly along the Kattak Road, although it did not rain as it had the last time they had been here. The southeastern border country of Lamarkand was more Pelosian in character than it was Lamark, and there were few castles atop the surrounding hilltops. Because of its proximity to Kyrelos, however, the landscape was dotted with monasteries and cloisters, and the sound of bells echoed mournfully across the fields.
"The clouds are moving in the wrong direction," Kyurik said as they were saddling their horses on the second morning out from Kyrelos. "An east wind in mid-autumn is very bad news. I'm afraid we're in for a hard winter, and that's not going to be pleasant for the troops campaigning on the plains of central Lamarkand."
They mounted and rode on toward the northeast. About mid-morning, Kring and Stragon rode forward to join Sparhawk at the head of the column.
"Friend Stragon here has been telling me some things about that Tamil woman, Martai," Kring said. "Did you ever get the chance to talk to her about me?"
"I sort of broke the ice on the subject," Sparhawk said.
"I was afraid of that. Some of the things Stragon told me are giving me some second thoughts about the whole notion. Oh? Did you know that she has knives strapped to her knees and elbows?
Yes.
I understand that they stick out whenever she bends one of her arms or legs.
I think that's the idea, yes.
Strogan tells me that once when she was young, three ruffians set upon her. She bent an elbow and slashed one across the throat, drove her knee into the second one's crotch, knocked the third down with her fist, and knifed him in the heart. I'm not entirely sure that I want a woman like that for a wife.
What did she say? When you told her about me, I mean.
She laughed, I'm afraid.
Laughed?
Kring sounded shocked.
I sort of gather that you're not exactly to her taste.
Laughed? At me?
I think your decision's wise, though, friend Kring, Sparhawk said. I don't think you two would get along very well.
Kring's eyes, however, were bulging.
Laughed at me, did she?
He said indignantly.
Well, we'll just see about that.
And he whirled his horse and rode back to join his men.
That might have worked out if you hadn't told him about the laughing, Strogan observed. Now he'll go out of his way to pursue her. I sort of like him, and I hate to think of what Murtai is likely to do to him if he gets too persistent.
Maybe we can talk him out of it, Sparhawk said.
I wouldn't really count on it.
What are you actually doing here, Strogan? Sparhawk asked the blonde man. In the Southern Kingdoms, I mean.
Strogan looked off toward a nearby monastery, his eyes distant.
Do you want the real truth, Sparhawk, or would you like to give me a moment or two to fabricate a story for you?
Why don't we start out with the truth? If I don't like that, then you can make something up.
Strogan flashed him a quick grin.
All right, he agreed. Up in Thalesia, I'm a counterfeit aristocrat. Down here I'm the real thing, or very close to it. I associate with kings and queens, the nobility and the higher clergy, on a more or less equal footing.
He raised one hand.
I'm not deluding myself, my friend, so don't become concerned about my sanity. I know what I am, a bastard thief. And I know that my proximity to the gentry down here is only temporary and that it's based entirely on my usefulness. I'm tolerated, not really accepted. My ego, however, is sizable.
I noticed that, Sparhawk said with a gentle smile.
Be nice, Sparhawk. Anyway, I'll accept this temporary and superficial equality, if only for the chance of some civilized conversation. Whores and thieves aren't really very stimulating companions, you understand, and about all they can really offer in the way of conversation is shop talk. Have you ever heard a group of whores sitting around talking shop?
I can't say that I have.
Strogan shuddered.
Absolutely awful. You learn things about men and women that you really don't want to know.
This won't last. You know that, don't you, Strogan? The time will come when things will return to normal and people will start closing their doors to you again.
You're probably right, but it's fun to pretend for a little while. And when it's all over, I'll have that much more reason to despise you stinking aristocrats.
Strogan paused. I do sort of like you, though, Sparhawk, for the time being, at least.
As they rode northeasterly, they began to encounter groups of armed men. The Lamarks were never very far from full mobilization anyway, and they were able to respond to their king's call to arms quickly. In a melancholy repetition of the events of some 5 centuries earlier, men from all the kingdoms of Western Aeosia streamed toward a battlefield in Lamarkand. Sparhawk and Euleth passed the time conversing in Troll. Sparhawk was not certain when he might have occasion to talk to a Troll, but since he had learned the language, even if by magic, it seemed a shame to let it slip away. They reached Kadok at the end of a gloomy day when the sunset was staining the clouds to the west with an orange glow much like that of a distant forest fire. The wind from the east was stiff, and it carried with it the first faint chill of the oncoming winter. Kadok was a walled town, stiff and gray and rigidly unlovely. In what was to become a custom, Kring bade them good night and led his men on through the city and out the east gate, to set up camp in the fields beyond. The Piloi were uncomfortable when confined in cities with such urban frivolities as walls, rooms, and roofs. Sparhawk and the rest of his friends found a comfortable inn near the center of town, bathed, changed clothes, and gathered in the common room for a supper of boiled ham and assorted vegetables. Sophrenia, as usual, declined the ham. "I've never understood why people would want to boil a perfectly good ham," Sir Bavier noted with some distaste. "Lamarcks oversalt their hams when they cure them," Carlton explained. "You have to boil a Lamarck ham for quite a while before it's edible. They're strange people. They try to make everything an act of courage, even eating." "Shall we go for a walk, Sparhawk?" Keurig suggested to his lord after they had eaten. "I think I've had just about enough exercise for one day." "You did want to know which way Martell went, didn't you?" "That's true, isn't it?" "All right, Keurig, let's go nose around a bit." When they reached the street, Sparhawk looked around. "This is likely to take us half the night," he said. "Hardly," Keurig disagreed. "We'll go to the east gate first, and if we don't find anything out there, we'll try the north one." "We just start asking people in the street?" Keurig sighed. "Use your head, Sparhawk. When people are on a journey, they usually start out first thing in the morning, about the same time that other people are going to work. A lot of workmen drink their breakfasts, and so the taverns are usually open. When a tavern keeper is waiting for the first customer of the day, he watches the street fairly closely. Believe me, Sparhawk, if Martell left Caddock in the last 3 days, at least half a dozen tavern keepers saw him." "You're an extraordinarily clever fellow, Keurig." "Somebody in this party has to be, my lord. As a group, knights don't spend a great deal of their time thinking. Your class prejudices are showing, Keurig. We all have our little flaws, I guess." The streets of Caddock were very nearly deserted, and the few citizens abroad hurried along with their cloaks whipping around their ankles in the stiff wind. The torches set in the walls at intersections flared and streamed as the wind tore at them, casting wavering shadows that danced on the cobblestones of the streets. The keeper of the first tavern they tried appeared to be his own best customer, and he had absolutely no idea of what time of day he normally opened his doors for business, or even what time of day it was now. The second tavern keeper was an unfriendly sort who spoke only in grunts. The third, however, proved to be a garrulous old fellow with a great fondness for conversation. "Well, now," he said, scratching at his head, "let's see if I can call it to mind. The last 3 days, you say?" "About that, yes," Keurig told him. "Our friend said he'd meet us here, but we got delayed, and it looks as if he went on without us."
"Can you describe him again?"
"Fairly large man. He might have been wearing armor, but I couldn't swear to that. If his head was uncovered, you'd have noticed him. He's got white hair."
"Can't seem to recollect nobody like that. Might could be he went out one t'other gates."
"That's possible, I suppose. But we're fairly sure he was going east.
Maybe he left town before you opened for business." "Now that's hardly likely. I opens that door there when the watch opens the gate. Some of the fellers as works here in town lives on farms out yonder, and I usually get some fairly brisk trade of a morning. Would your friend have been traveling alone?"
"No," Keurig replied. "He had a churchman with him, and a lady of aristocratic background. There'd also have been a slack-jawed young fellow who looks about as stupid as a stump, and a big burly man with a face like a gorilla."
"Oh, that bunch. You should have told me about Ape Face right off. They rode through here about daylight yesterday morning. And a gorilla he was talking about. He clumb down off'n his horse, and he come in here bellerin' for ale. He don't talk none too good, does he?"
"It usually takes him about half a day to think up an answer when somebody says hello to him." The tavern keeper cackled shrilly.
"That's him, all right. He don't smell none too sweet neither, does he?"
Keurig grinned at him and spun a coin across the counter to him. "Oh, I don't know," he said. "He isn't too much worse than an open cesspool. Thank you for the information, my friend."
"You think you'll be able to catch up with him?"
"Oh, we'll catch them, all right," Keurig replied fervently. "Sooner or later." "Were there any others with them?"
"No, just M5. Exceptin' for the gorilla, they all had their cloaks pulled up round their heads. That's probably how come I couldn't see the one with the white hair.
They was movin' along at a pretty good clip, though, so's if you wants to catch 'em, you're gonna have to push your horses some." "We can do that, my friend. Thanks again." And Keurig and Sparhawk went back out into the street. "Was that more or less what you needed to know, my lord?"
Kurek asked. That old fellow was a gold mine, Kurek. We've gained a bit of time on Martell. We know that he doesn't have any troops with him, and we know that he's going toward Morterra. We know something else, too, Sparhawk. Oh, what's that? Ardus still needs a bath. Sparhawk laughed. Ardus always needs a bath. We'll probably have to pour about a hogshead of water on him before we bury him. Otherwise the ground might just spit him back out again. Let's go on back to the inn. When Sparhawk and Kurek re-entered the low-beamed common room of the inn, however, they found that their party had expanded slightly. Talon sat all innocent-eyed at the table with a number of hard stares focused on him. Chapter 21
I'm a royal messenger, the boy said quickly as Sparhawk and Kurek approached the table, so don't start reaching for your belts, either of you.
You're a royal what? Sparhawk asked him.
I'm carrying a message to you from the Queen, Sparhawk.
Let's see the message.
I committed it to memory. We really wouldn't want messages like that falling into unfriendly hands, would we?
All right, let's hear it then.
It's sort of private, Sparhawk.
That's all right, we're among friends.
I can't see why you're behaving this way. I'm just obeying the Queen's command, that's all.
The message, Talon.
Well, she's getting ready to leave for Simera.
That's nice. Sparhawk's tone was flat.
And she's very worried about you.
I'm touched.
She's feeling well, though.
The additions Talon was tacking on were growing more and more lame. That's good to know.
She says that she loves you.
And?
Well, that's all, really.
It's a strangely garbled message, Talon. I think maybe you've left something out. Why don't you go over it again?
Well, she was talking to Murtai and Platami, and me, of course, and she said that she wished there was some way she could get word to you to let you know what she was doing and exactly how she felt.
She said this to you?
Well, I was in the room when she said it.
Then we can't really say that she ordered you to come here, can we?
Not in so many words, I suppose, but aren't we supposed to sort of anticipate her wishes? She is the queen, after all. May I?
Sophronia asked. Of course, Sparhawk replied. I've already found out what I want to know.
Maybe, she said. Maybe not.
She turned to the boy.
Talon?
Yes, Sophronia.
That's the weakest, most clumsy and obviously false story I've ever heard from you. It doesn't even make any sense, particularly in view of the fact that she's already sent Stragon to do more or less the same thing. Is that really the best you could come up with?
He even managed to look embarrassed.
It's not a lie, he said. The Queen said exactly what I told you she did. I'm sure she did, but what was it that moved you to come galloping after us to repeat some idle comments?
He looked a little confused.
Oh, dear,
Sophronia sighed. She began to scold Afrael and Styrek at some length. I think I missed something there. Colton sounded baffled.
I'll explain in a moment, Colton, Sophronia said. Talon, you have an enormous gift for spontaneous prevarication. What happened to it? Why didn't you just cook up a lie that was at least a little bit plausible?
He squirmed a bit.
It just wouldn't have seemed right, he said sullenly. You felt that you shouldn't really lie to your friends, is that it? Something like that, I guess.
Praise God, Xavier said in stunned fervor.
Don't be too quick to start offering up prayers of thanksgiving, Xavier, she told him.
End of Side 8. Change Side Selector Switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.